and I just learned the best spell of all.
What's that?
Sleep.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to my Alchemical Bromance. I'm Joey Harrison, and this is...
I'm Eric Arneson. That one's sweet.
And joining us today is Chuck Dunning, the author of Contemplative Masonry. Chuck and myself and Eric, we've known each other for several years and had a lot of good times together. So, Chuck, would you like to say a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. You know, where do you start with something like that? I think the thing that most people would be interested in knowing about me is that, you know, I had a kind of a background that didn't really prepare me for all of this contemplative stuff. I've heard some of your stories, guys, over the years, and I think out of all of us, probably Eric is the weirdest of the bunch in terms of, certainly in terms of longevity.
Sure.
And but I did come by some of this stuff naturally, developed a pretty serious interest in contemplative matters early in life, actually, but didn't get serious about it until I was in my 20s. And for me, that was something I was looking for when I came to Freemasonry, and that's kind of how my whole story with all of this begins.
Sure.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask you, because I seem to remember hearing a story from you that you had previous experience with some sort of contemplative work or some sort of esoteric practice when you came to Freemasonry.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Do you want to tell us about it, or is it a secret? It's okay if it's a secret.
Well, there might be some things that I omit.
Okay.
Like I said, I had kind of developed an interest in these kinds of things at a young age. I think one of the stories that I have told a number of times and that is, you know, that plays well with Masons is that I grew up reading Pike's Morals and Dogma. It was on the family bookshelf. My dad didn't mind that, you know, it was a book that was supposed to be available to the public.
Oh, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we are being joined by our third co-host, Matt Anthony.
Hey, Matt.
Or Manthony is how he's
been there. Now he's universe. Back.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Anthony.
How you doing, brother?
Manthony has entered the building.
Dude, good. You know, now that Matt's here, I'm going to open my beer.
And while you do that, aww, I'm going to figure out my technical issues. So
you're having technical issues?
Yeah, I'm trying to get my feed recording.
Okay, I'm already recording, so you can totally just start whenever you want.
Okay, so you're recording my feed as well?
Yeah, that was super loud.
Okay.
That's okay. It's okay. Be enthusiastic.
Okay, so I don't have... there's no need for me to record on my end?
No, I guess not. I mean, you can if you want to. I know that of the three of us, you are the most recording savvy. So, you know,
I think since you've already got it going, and you can see the levels, then we're probably good.
Okay, cool. I can't see the levels. I'm just doing it from the command line. It's
command line.
All right. So, we were just making Chuck tell us his origin story.
Ah,
so Chuck, I think you were to the part where you were 20. You were 20.
Yeah. In this lifetime, right?
Right.
Okay. Basically, I had I had grown up with an interest that had been developed by Morals and Dogma Lightfoot's Manual of the Lodge. And so by the time I was in my 20s, I was already interested in esoteric things and the whole idea of meditation and contemplative practice was particularly interesting to me because I got that was the key for real depth of insight and experience in these different esoteric traditions. And mm-hmm. And so I kind of messed around a little bit with some different kinds of meditation and stuff, but it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I started to take it more seriously and get some real instruction. So I was taking a college course called The Ancient Wisdom Traditions with Dr. John F. Miller III, my philosophy professor at the University of North Texas. And he taught meditation techniques. He taught a not for credit seminar in meditation. And so I studied with him, and while I was doing that not for credit seminar in meditation, I was also taking his course in the ancient wisdom traditions, in which he referenced meditation a lot. But that was a kind of a review of the Western esoteric tradition. And my term project in that class was to basically do an analysis of Freemasonry as an initiatic tradition, an esoteric initiatic tradition. And I used Morals and Dogma and some other texts for that research. And so by the time the semester was over, I was ready to petition. I'd been surrounded by Masons all my life. My dad was a Mason. My grandfather was a Mason. My father-in-law was a Mason. Masons all around me. And so I petitioned. I gave my dad the news that I was ready, and he practically whipped one out of his back pocket. and then got into Freemasonry and joined with the idea that, you know, I would find out that all of these Masons that I had known all of these years were doing contemplative practices and you know, spiritual disciplines and stuff, and that I would finally be mentored in that, you know, secret tradition. And
it's good to know that you were just as naive as we were.
Yeah, exactly. Did not find that.
Wait, so you're trying to tell me that your dad afterwards didn't be like, Chuck, it is now time for you to see the secret room with our altars and black robes in the back of the house? You didn't.
Well, I told you there were some things I wouldn't talk about.
Oh, right. Okay. So some things, yeah, of course.
No, that never happened. You know, the secret room in our house was full of guns and stuff like that. So.
Oh, so nice. It was basically like any other Texas house and most Oregon houses.
Pretty much. Yeah.
What did you pick to drink?
I'm drinking New Belgium Ranger.
Oh,
IPA.
That is a classic. Classic might not be a good word because it's actually not a super old beer. They've only been making it since 2008 or 2009.
Yeah,
wow, look at the
beer. But I love it. For me, it's the perfectly balanced IPA for me. I love it.
Oh yeah. I like that one a lot too. And it was an interesting departure for New Belgium because before this they had mostly stuck with Belgian styles. Mm-hmm. Maybe not entirely, but I remember how excited the beer reps were when they started having this IPA. And they're like, finally people in Oregon will start drinking our beer. and they did. I mean, it sold really well. It's a very tasty beer. How about you?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, yes. Joey? You were drinking out of some strange-looking vessel earlier. It looked
that's a Starbucks tumbler.
A Starbucks
insulated.
Yeah. Can you show it to us? Show it in the video. Like, can we get a better look?
Here you go.
Oh, very nice.
You can't hardly see anything in this feed, but yeah. So it's just to keep it cold, but I'm having the Inversion IPA.
Oh, from Deschutes.
From Deschutes.
Deschutes, yeah.
That's a good one too.
It's good stuff.
And Matt, what flavor of La Croix do you have tonight?
No La Croix tonight, but I am I'm drinking some locally roasted coffee.
Oh my God, you're not allowed to be here anymore.
Is it delicious?
Next time, lie to us.
I'm drinking.
You guys have got to guard the West Gate here.
Yeah,
that's right.
So even with all the coffee, you are still the last one here. So the caffeine, it must not be affecting you very much. I'm drinking the salted caramel stout from Breakside Brewing.
Very nice.
They're a Portland brewery, and they're pretty good. You know, it's pretty rare that they go wrong. Matt, you went there with me once.
I did. It's a cool place. Yeah. I've liked their beer for a while before we got to go there.
And now, wait, did you say
you don't?
Now you don't like their beer anymore?
Yeah, now that I've gone, I hate it. No,
it's old news.
So 2 weeks ago, it's over.
Yeah. But it's good.
Potential competitor.
I've never had this beer before, and it's... I guess I haven't paid very much attention to it. Hold on a second.
You haven't had that one before?
So speaking of beer in Texas, Chuck, what's the craft brew scene like down there? It's been a long time since I've been there.
It's really starting to grow. I almost chose a local beer for tonight, but I really wanted an IPA. And so the local brewery is RAR in Fort Worth. There's also Revolver and a couple of others, but RAR is the one that's actually in downtown. Well, not downtown, but centrally located in Fort Worth. And a very good brewery. One of my favorite beers there is the Texas Red. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good beer any time of the year. I really like it a lot. They also have a winter warmer that is, kind of like an English brown ale. Mm-hmm. But their IPA is called Storm Cloud. It's okay. But it doesn't. I mean, it just doesn't come close for me to the Ranger.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Chuck, I was down in Texas visiting you several years ago, and we went to a brewery, didn't we?
I think we went to RAR. Yeah.
Okay. What does RAR stand for? Is it
RAR and Sons?
Huh?
Yeah, it's RAR and Sons. That's an actual name.
Oh, like a German name, like
R A H R.
Okay,
that's it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Cool.
Speaking of Fort Worth, I think I've told you guys this story before, but I'm going to tell it again since it's being recorded. I was one of the first weeks when I was in Fort Worth when I was doing some work down there, sitting at a stoplight in downtown Fort Worth, and a giant herd of cattle comes running through the streets in downtown Fort Worth with cowboys on horses chasing them. And I couldn't believe what was happening. I don't know if they just got loose from the cattle yards or what happened, but
that's a daily show that they put on.
Oh yeah. It was fun.
I remember it was pretty fun to go to the part of Fort Worth that's like the old stockyard area.
Exactly.
And, I still have my red, at least I think I still have the red plastic cup that I drank Shinerbach out of there on the street. Well, so Chuck, I have been watching your other podcasts. You've been on a lot of them. Is this your third or your fourth or your tenth?
Well, let's see. I started with Laudable Pursuit. Mm-hmm. I did 357 Productions. I did Masonic Light, After Lodge. This is my fifth one.
Okay, I have not listened to all of them. But I was assuming that, you know, all of those other ones were Masonic podcasts. And this podcast, even though all of us are Freemasons, is not a Masonic podcast.
Right.
So your book, Contemplative Masonry, is it the sort of book that a non-Mason would enjoy? Would a non-Mason get much out of it?
I think that's possible.
Yeah.
I do know some non-Masons that have purchased the book, but there are things that, you know, I assume that the reader understands.
Mm-hmm.
There are references, like a lot of books that are written for Masonic audiences, I make references that I assume that the reader will know what I'm talking about, and I don't offer explanations for the uninitiated. And so I think what it would really offer more than anything else to a non-Mason is a view into understanding what the psychology of Freemasonry is, because that's chapter one of the book. Mm-hmm. and what it is about Freemasonry that qualifies it as an esoteric tradition in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's chapter two of the book. And then the exercises, particularly if someone has a pretty good familiarity with a breadth of different kinds of contemplative practices. The exercises and the explanations for how they relate to the degrees will offer a lot of insight to non-Masons about what the potential is for spiritual experience within the craft. Mm-hmm. But there will be some things that, unless a person is very well read and like has, you know, access to exposures of different sorts, they're probably going to miss some things.
Well, I was just reading the section on dream interpretation.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty interesting and definitely would be useful to non-Masons. Is that something that you learned through your counseling practice or?
Yeah. You know, those dream interpretation techniques are things that I have been using as a counselor and a therapist for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. One of them, I mean, there's actually kind of two basic approaches, but essentially the whole interpretive process is really very similar to what's practiced in Gestalt therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a kind of a little bit of a Jungian flavor as well. For the most part, it really tends to more run along Gestalt lines because it's Jungian is not extremely prescriptive in dream interpretation, but it's definitely more so than Gestalt.
Okay. I feel a little lost. What's the difference? So can you explain the difference between Jungian and Gestalt therapy then, or Jungian Gestalt?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. So the Jungian approach to therapy begins with the whole theory of archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he takes essentially a kind of neo-Freudian perspective on the psyche, which means that, you know, that there is this thing called the unconscious. And then expands it to say that within the unconscious there are we can deduce that there are these things, for lack of a better term, we'll just use things, these things called archetypes. And archetypes, the idea of archetypes have been around, the basic idea of archetypes have been around for a very long time. Pythagoras and his idea of numbers, Plato specifically used the word, talking about the sense of that there is some sort of ideal form that guides the manifestation of things in the physical plane. And this ideal form exists at a kind of super rational level of manifestation. And Jung said that you can look at human psyches and human behavior, and behavior is obviously a product of the psyche. You can look at that and you can see that there are these real common patterns that transcend culture, and that they come from some source, or that they are given rise by some source that is outside the control of the conscious mind.
Mm.
The conscious mind actually reacts to them rather than controls them. It can interact with them intentionally also, but at first, until you become conscious of them and you start to intentionally try to engage them, that you basically are just reacting to the effect of the archetypes on your psyche. And so in the dream interpretation of the Jungian approach, they try to include Jung's basic understanding of the archetypes, and particularly those that are relevant to the personality, like persona, shadow, anima or animus, and the syzygy or the wise old man or wise old woman. And I can break those down, the persona being the mask that the personality wears in whatever context it happens to be in socially, and the shadow being all those things that the personality tries to deny about itself and to exclude from itself, but they're still there, at least in potential. And then the anima or the animus representing the kind of polar opposite of whatever the gender identity is of the given psyche, which represents the path to wholeness. The whole Jungian model is very much about integrating all of these different aspects of the psyche and as many of the different archetypes as bring them all into harmony with each other. And so that means resolving oppositions, bringing harmony and balance between things that seem to be opposite from each other. So working to integrate the shadow, working to integrate the anima for males, for people who identify as male and masculine, their deeper archetype would be the anima. And for females, it would be the animus, which would have a masculine quality. The anima has a feminine quality. It's actually the Greek word for soul, and or Latin, one of the two. One of you guys will have to tell me that.
It's Latin.
And it's Latin. That's right. Yeah, it's Latin. And then, yes, because Greek is psyche. And then for females, it's animus, because that archetype would be masculine. And then beyond that, there's the archetype of wholeness and complete integration, the whole self.
So you were talking about integrating opposites, and that's sort of the work of Jungian therapy, or sort of the goal of a person going through Jungian therapy.
Essentially, yes, is to integrate.
Mm-hmm. So then, if all of the archetypes that you were mentioning so far all seem to be things that need to be integrated, and is the archetype of the whole person then a separate type of archetype? Is it the integrated archetype? So is it one that we don't really manifest or possess until the integration has happened?
Well, it actually kind of works behind the scenes as a kind of guide to the integration process all along.
Like a holy guardian angel.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a genius, like the personal genius, sort of like the higher self that is sort of telling you, if you want to be groovy, do this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and sometimes, you know, slapping you around if you start straying away from wholeness too much.
Uh-huh.
And
I don't know anything about that.
And so what happens is that it's always there and it's always exerting its influence, but because its influence is about integration, it's not until you achieve a certain level of integration that you really get to more directly experience it. And even begin to, the personality even begin to identify with it to a certain extent and say, okay, yeah, I recognize that this is closer to my true self, or some other term you might use for whatever that wholeness or that greater possibility of who and what you are actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are definitely correspondences there between the whole process of moving from a vision of the Holy Guardian Angel and Malkuth in the Kabbalistic path, the Hermetic Kabbalah, all the way up to knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel in Teferith.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really close parallel there to the integration process in Jungian therapy. So in Jungian therapy, when you're doing dream interpretation, you're looking at the characters in your dream as representing these archetypes. So, for example, a man, a person who identifies as male and masculine, if he's dreaming of a woman, then he's probably going to be at least a little suspicious that that's a representation of his anima.
Mm-hmm.
If he's having a dream in which there's a bad guy, or somebody that's causing problems or playing tricks on him or something like that, well, he's going to probably consider that as a representation of his shadow. And so you automatically kind of have this interpretive framework that's built into Jungian dream interpretation. With Gestalt, you don't have that. Gestalt is much closer to kind of a pure phenomenological approach to psychotherapy. And by phenomenological, I mean just encountering experience as directly as possible. And so what you have in Gestalt is rather than assume that different characters are going to align with some particular meaning, like an archetype, you try to go back into the dream and even become the different elements of the dream. Imagine yourself as the different characters. Imagine yourself as more closely interacting with those different characters. And you know, and this is a meditative process. So if you were talking about having read that, you can see how mm-hmm. the Gestalt approach directly influences what I'm offering there in the book.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. All right.
Well, that's interesting because in your book you've got a there's a section called "Let There Be Light" about imagination.
Yes.
Do you want to describe a little bit about how imagination plays such a major role in the development of your spiritual self?
Boy, that's
because I know for me personally, starting years ago in the beginning, it's just, you know, it's something you do. You're trying to imagine the stuff, and you know, after doing it for a very long time, it's almost second nature.
But
when you try to describe things to people, and maybe you're coaching somebody along, it's a real challenge for some people to imagine things vividly, in that way.
That's true.
Yeah.
But those skills can be developed. I mean, everybody sure. has imagination, and some people are more naturally talented with it than others, just like anything. But everybody has probably more capacity to develop their imagination than they actually do.
Do you think that we're hindered a little bit by the way imagination is belittled by our society now? Like, imagination is sort of, I feel like a lot of times it's brushed off as a children's game or the domain of crazy writers and
right,
artists.
Yeah, we I think we kind of have a love-hate relationship with imagination as a society,
mm-hmm.
because on the one hand, we admire and are dazzled by the products of imagination that show up in different forms, like different kinds of art, whether it's music, painting, or sculpture, or dance. We put a lot of money into imagination, particularly in the form of marketing and advertising. There's a lot of imagination that goes into that.
Ooh, now you're starting. Now you're starting to sound like Ioan Culianu.
Okay, let me see if I can change things here a little bit.
No, I mean that's not bad. He had great ideas. You know, he was.
Yeah. It's true though. If you think of everything from our cell phones to the computers, everything started in the world of imagination
right.
and worked its way down into the physical realm.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's pretty
sure.
important.
Yeah. But see, the thing is that in our society, we pretty much try to enslave imagination to profit motives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we don't allow the imagination to run wild strictly for the purpose of, and I'm not saying that running wild is the only thing to do with imagination to develop it or to take advantage of it. But we don't allow all of the potentials of imagination to come out because we limit it by creating this little narrow funnel that it's, you know, that it's only worth tapping into if it makes somebody money.
Right.
And it can, obviously, right? It obviously does. But we miss a lot of things. I mean, think about all of the things that have been accomplished in science that we haven't really profited from, or initially didn't really profit from. There was no profit motive, but people just wanted to use their imaginations in the process of discovery. And I think that's one of the great keys to get back to your question, Joey, is that one of the things that imagination does for us is it dramatically facilitates the process of discovery. And particularly since we're talking about things of the esoteric nature, what we're really talking about in psychological terms is discovery of oneself. And since oneself intersects with everything else, then we wind up, you know, coming to that old saw, that old esoteric saw of know yourself, and
right.
You shall know the ways of all the gods, you know. And so there's where imagination is important. Imagination is a wonderful tool to discovering the self and discovering the interrelatedness of the self with everything else.
So I'm reading this book called Big Magic. Eric was with me when I bought it. He made fun of me at the brewery afterwards.
I got my job, don't I?
You do. The universe buries strange jewels deep within us all and then stands back to see if we can find them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she says that in a chapter where she's talking about kind of just letting your imagination run wild, but bringing it back to what, you know, what you're passionate about and things like that. So mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway,
quote.
Yeah. I love that quote.
I'm sorry.
It's actually, it's a fantastic book.
I totally take it all back.
You can read the whole book in like 30 minutes too. It's a quick read.
Wow.
What's not the 30 name minutes. Of it again? I'm just kidding. Big Magic. It's the same author that wrote Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, Elizabeth okay.
Gilbert.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's why I made fun of you.
Yeah, I knew it.
See, Eric, if you were in touch with your anima, you would love Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, I touch my anima all the time.
I cried like a baby in that movie. I'm not afraid to admit it.
I don't think I've seen Eat, Pray, Love, nor do I know very much about it, what it's about. When you mentioned the title of the book, I associated it with whatever that movie that Julia Roberts was in. Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't read the book, but the movie was good, at least at the time when I watched it.
I've read the book. I don't really recall if I've seen the movie, so.
You wouldn't. Yeah. I mean.
She found herself in Indonesia, so.
Oh, totally.
Connected with that story.
And yeah. I remember there being food pretty often, but I don't remember a lot of prayer.
But, yeah, yeah. Well, there's more of that in the book.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and it's kind of a prayer in a really broad sense.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Okay.
It's interesting, Eric, because I bought that book on a whim, found it randomly at that cool shop in Portland. Uh-huh. It was a couple of days later. No. Actually, it was a couple of weeks later. I'd forgotten about the book, found it, and I thought, wow, I need to read this book at some point. That day, I'm driving to work listening to a podcast about marketing, speaking of marketers and imagination.
Uh-huh.
And this girl that is very involved with digital marketing and helping coach people, she goes on and on about how she just read this book. And it's like this amazing book about creativity, and that's the one. So
Big Magic.
I started reading it.
Cool.
Just let the magic happen, Eric. You're going to read the book. You're going to love it.
Oh, jeez. I'll put it on my list. I got to finish Chuck's book first, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I read the original way, way back in the day.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting story, too, just how this whole thing came about.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, I could. Eric, I'd really be interested to hear your recollections of those early days and the beginnings of all of that.
All right. Well, I mean, I met you through Jay Kinney.
Yep.
Whom I suppose if we have esotericists listening to our podcast, they'll say, oh, Jay Kinney, I remember him. He was the editor of Gnosis with Richard Smalley, and he wrote that great book and that other book and all of those comics that had naked people in them. in the 70s.
Subversive anti-establishment.
Yeah, and I met Jay through Freemasonry. We're really going to have to start branching out and do episodes that have, like, no Freemasonry at all someday, like, if we ever learn about other stuff. So he, I think, introduced me to you online, and I wasn't among the first wave of your book people. But I was there. I think when I got there, you had just finished the Master Mason portion, the third degree portion. Although I don't remember exactly. It was a long time ago, you know. It was a long time 2000 ago. Or 2001?
Well, I didn't actually make the first manuscript available publicly until 2000.
Okay.
So the actual, I started writing the material sometime in the late 90s.
Okay, so I must have gotten it after you'd made it available, because I wasn't even a Mason until 2000. You know, I too was hoping to get some sort of esoteric journey out of Freemasonry, and had a lot of frustration in finding that. And by the time I got to your book, I had already been working with Donald Michael Craig's Modern Magic. And I believe I had also already read John Michael Greer's Magical Lodge. So I was sort of familiar with some of the approaches you were taking to visualization and stuff, where I immediately associated them with the Magical Lodge stuff, and with the, you know, sort of the Golden Dawn style lodge stuff, which made, you know, which made sense to me. I have always, so to me, it was really fascinating. I was already in the middle of another practice or working through another practice. So it was hard to fit it all in. I incorporated some of your stuff, and I kind of started doing more and more of the contemplative masonry stuff as I drifted away from the Golden Dawn style thing, and used it in the same sort of way, and found it to be very effective. I thought it was really interesting. And I loved that. I loved how mysterious you had to be about the whole thing. You know, the whole fear of the conservative Texas Masonic mindset. And so that part I thought was a really interesting part of the story. And I loved your pseudonym, your... what was it? Thomas St. John, right?
Yeah.
years later, I came across somebody using that on Facebook as a pseudonym. And I was like, is that Chuck? It was not Chuck. It was another Mason who just didn't want to use his real name on the internet. so that was mine. When you published it, so your decision to publish this book and you're actually, you know, using your real name... was really significant to me, because, or I felt like it was very significant for Texas Freemasonry, because it meant either you had stopped being afraid of the conservative element of Freemasonry in Texas, or they had lost so much power that you no longer felt threatened by them.
Yeah.
Which was it?
I think I had lost my personal fear a lot earlier. I had kind of come to a place where I was more or less okay with the fact that, you know, I mean, I was giving talks, in lodges and stuff like that, and talking about these spiritual disciplines that could be applied to Freemasonry, and so it's not like I really had anything to hide anymore, but what I was concerned about was that the message itself might get shut down if the publication was done in a more traditional way, with a named author in a hard copy, you know, that was publicly available. I was concerned for a long time that, you know, that something like that might be looked upon as inappropriate for law-abiding Freemasons to consume, and things have just changed. Things are very different in the fraternity now than they were in 2000.
Oh, for sure.
And, yeah, and certainly very different than they were in 1988 when I was initiated, passed, and raised. And so what I see now is that there are lots of guys coming to the fraternity. We talk about the millennials a lot of times, and it's not just millennials that are doing this. A lot of guys are coming to the fraternity now looking for the same thing. They're looking for a contemplative experience. They're looking for mentoring in contemplative experience. Mm-hmm. They want to discover the hidden reaches of themselves. They want to discover the interconnectedness of themselves with other things, and certainly with deity. And that's what they're coming to the fraternity for. And I think that's always happened. But the fraternity hasn't been in a place always where it would respond warmly to that particular quest. And so the fraternity now, because of the membership issues that it has been suffering, is out of necessity, out of survival mode, opening itself up to more possibilities for how it can exist and flourish. So there's perfect opportunity now to publicly say, this can be a real part of your Masonic experience, and there are brothers here who've been doing this who will support you and welcome you. And so, you know, do not be afraid. Move ahead.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I have an anecdote related to that. I've been doing a Kabbalah club at our local Scottish Rite. And one of the interesting things that's happened is some of the older Masons have come up to me and said, I came to Freemasonry looking for this 40 years ago, and nobody was doing it. And now finally people are, and in fact, when I brought it up, everybody would say, no, we don't do that here. And now here you are talking about it. And there's, so my Kabbalah club is actually, has quite a number of the older members.
Yeah.
Have been attending.
It really does. I was surprised to see that for some reason.
That's very cool. You know, one of the in the Guthrie Scottish Rite, we have a pretty dynamic education program there where we offer lectures on the degrees and discussions. It's not just lecture, but discussions on the different degrees for returning members, in addition to having the Academy of Reflection, which is focused on contemplative experience, and we offer meditation sessions throughout the reunions. And I've had these old guys in the white hats come up that have been Masons for, some of them have the 50-year blue caps, right? Mm-hmm. And they come up to me and they say, you know, I've been doing this stuff my entire life. I'm a member of this society, this Rosicrucian organization, or this, you know, some other organization, and I've been doing these practices, and I never thought that I would see a time when I could tell anybody in Freemasonry about that, and I'm so glad that I can do that now. And I think on the one hand that's just beautiful, and on the other hand it's also sad. But, you know, that isn't that often the way life is, this, that beauty and sadness are just right there, two sides of the same coin.
Oh, geez, Chuck, open another beer.
actually, it is about... So, maybe we can take a commercial break at this point.
Oh, yeah, we're going to commercial break.
Commercial break. I got to go get one, too.
All right.
Mute.
And we're back from break.
see if we can get the sound of my beer being poured.
Oh yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, this is also an ASMR podcast.
Did you get that?
Oh yeah, that was great. I'm gonna do that too as soon as I.
You guys are making me jealous. I want a beer.
You can't have one.
Yeah, no beer for you.
Look at the head on that.
Nice.
Oh yeah.
Very nice. Look at the head on mine. No, wait. Wow. Never mind.
It looks very minerally.
Well, I already forgot. What are you drinking, Joey?
Right. This one is actually from one of my favorite breweries, and yours too, also, I think. Fort George in Astoria.
Yes, oh, yeah. I love Fort George.
Big Guns IPA. Or no, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, I'm still Session IPA. I'm still working on the same beer because it was a big bottle.
it's okay. We know you're lightweight.
Oh yeah, totally. All right, so Chuck, I have another question. I wrote down some questions before the podcast, like any responsible. See, look at that. Yeah. My next question for you is, so you wrote Contemplative Masonry, like version one, and it was out by like 2000, you said.
Right.
So it's been 17 years. What has changed in it? What have you added? What have you taken away? What did you realize is a horrible mistake? Did you drive any Masons insane with odd magical practices? And you were like,
I have not heard any.
Maybe I'll take that Beelzebub summoning out at the third degree practice.
What do you think happened to me, Eric?
I was just thought it was your hair, Joey.
Yeah, no, all the stuff that I took out of it is now being used by another esoteric order that does things that are that bend to the left. Let me put it up. No,
the order of Dagon.
So I didn't really take anything out. Everything that had been in there originally stayed in. I mean, I did clean up some of the writing, but mostly what I did was add things. And so I added two chapters to the original three. The original book just had an introduction, which gave it's basically the same introduction as in this book, which is just a kind of overview of the psychological model that I'm working with and that I see inherent within Freemasonry. And then it was three chapters that were meditative practices, mindfulness practices, other kinds of inner work corresponding to some major themes in each of the three degrees in the Craft Lodge. And so what I added to that was two chapters, each of them based upon papers that I had written at different times during those 17 years, one on the psychology of Freemasonry. So I took the basic model that I had written into the introduction and just expanded it, actually got into more detail because, you know, in the actual academic discipline of psychology, if you're going to say that something is a psychology or a theory of psychology, well, then there's certain criteria it needs to meet. There are certain questions that theory needs to answer or model needs to answer. And so that's what I did with that paper. And that paper was originally written for the education program in the Guthrie Valley. And that became my first chapter of the book. And the second chapter of the book was a paper that I originally wrote for a publication out of San Marcos Lodge down in South Texas, South Central Texas. Their publication called The Emerald Tablet.
What?
And,
really?
How long
have they been doing that?
It's a good question. I think they had been doing it for like a couple of years when I wrote this, and I think that was in 2013, maybe.
Man, Freemasonry is getting weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love
it.
This is great.
By the way, if you ever get to visit San Marcos Lodge, you really need to go down there and see that lodge.
Yeah, John Tolbert's done a great job of...
Oh, is that John Tolbert's lodge? Of course. Yes, he is.
Yeah.
He is a prince among weird Masons in Texas, I believe.
I'm telling you, the outside of that building, it looks like a tool shed on the Texas prairie out there. Mm-hmm. And then you walk inside, and it's like you've stepped through some kind of astral portal. You know,
that's really cool.
What? You know, and you kind of look back outside, and there's the other world.
Ooh.
And it's like,
Hey,
you know?
Is that the red? Is that the when you looked back outside there? I saw the red book right behind you. Is that the one with all the pictures?
It is.
Oh, nice. That's the good one.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Yeah. That's a prized possession.
I'm gonna have to integrate that jealousy later.
Bring it together.
Yeah.
Well, the first step is awareness, and you've already got that one. So,
cheers to me.
Cheers. Yeah. So the second chapter of the book is this paper that I wrote for them, and it's a straightforward approach to Masonic esotericism. And it's basically just going through Masonic ritual and looking for the ways that its own words point to the fact that Freemasonry offers an esoteric experience. And by esoteric, we mean it in the broader sense of an inward, internal experience, an experience of looking within oneself, looking within the ritual, for deeper meaning.
Well, hear. I mean, I feel like those are the words in Masonic ritual that everybody has trained themselves to ignore.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you know, I've even heard some Masons say, oh, you know, basically, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, that's just all fancy window dressing. It's just there to get you to think something special is going on.
There's nothing
just
special
you,
here.
Just
move
to
along.
Get you in the door.
Move along.
That's it.
That's These are not the contemplative practices you are looking for.
Yeah.
all we need is bodies flipping pancakes.
Yeah. and you know, and to be fair, it's not what everybody wants out of Freemasonry, you know.
Oh yeah.
No, absolutely not. There's so many different flavors of Freemasonry depending on where you go, and I don't think there's any right one. You know, I got myself personally, I got a little bit hoity toity and you know, felt like I was very sophisticated.
I can relate.
So, but then I came to a realization it's different for everybody.
Yeah.
And it fills, you can definitely find the group that fills the need for you as a man.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the great things about the fraternity is that I can have these wonderful brotherly relationships with guys who have very, very different desires for what they're getting out of the fraternity from me.
Sure.
But we can still connect on this thing of caring about each other, mutually respecting each other, being able to have a good time with each other. And that's, I think that's just fantastic. I think that's one of the greatest things about Freemasonry, and something that sets it apart from almost, well, from any other esoteric organization or society that I know of.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That might be true, although I haven't had the inside experience in other societies, so that's, but I imagine it's got to be.
It's interesting because when I went to Texas, I was initiated into an esoteric society there, which it was amazing going from Oklahoma City to Texas and finding this, you know, Kabbalistic Golden Dawn style. It was a spinoff from BOTA group. Ultimately, I didn't stay in it long, but the people that I've made some lifelong, just amazing friends through it. And it, you know, a couple of those are Freemasons, but we had that bond of Freemasonry and it stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, actually this kind of gets to the final piece of my answer to Eric's question about what changed in the book. The one thing that I added in terms of
a long answer. Did we start that question before the commercial break? I can't remember.
You know, I've been listening to y'all's podcasts, and I'm just trying to continue with the spirit of things that you've established in the past.
Thank you.
I I mean, if I can't be a long-winded son of a gun, you know, I'm not going to fit in.
Oh, right? Yeah, you're in the wrong spot.
Except for Matt Anthony, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You run with it.
It's going to be hard to edit out all of Matt's chatter.
I know, right?
Yeah, your listeners really don't have any idea. I've been dumbfounded by just what a chatterbox he is.
Yeah, it's amazing. Luckily, there's this great filter in our audio editing software. It's we call it the Anthony filter. It just whoosh strips it all out. All of his smart ass remarks, all of his heckling. I mean, heckling, really, Matt? Or maybe
good old Matt.
Yeah. Now he's speechless.
I am now.
I'm a little bit jealous of your setup there, Matt. Look at that. Look at that.
Oh, just this mic stand?
Yeah.
It looks really professional. The thing. $12 on Amazon.
You got to get some big headphones, though.
Yeah.
He's got them. He's got big headphones. They're just
That's what all the cool podcasts are doing these days.
All right, sorry, Chuck. So you're finishing the answer to the question, what changed in 17 years? We're going to call this segment of the podcast is going to be called 17 Years in 17 Hours.
It's great when a guest tries to keep the podcasters on track.
Yeah.
Well, see, part of the deal is I've just been around you guys for so many years that it's like, you know, this is the one group of guys I'm with where I don't feel like the ADD guy.
Yeah, that's for sure.
The last thing is, and I talk about this in the preface of the book, is that a major discovery of my own in my own esoteric practice, my own spiritual practice during those 17 years was coming to a realization that the central theme of my life, and this is very much connected with my experience of the wise old man and the Jungian way of thinking, or the holy guardian angel in the Hermetic way of thinking, that the unifying theme of my life was love. And so I added an exercise to the Master Mason chapter that deals directly with experiencing love in a deeper, broader way. Mm-hmm. And it fits entirely because a major portion of the Master Mason degree, a significant element of the Master Mason degree, has to do with providing him a working tool that is about love. And that had been a major omission. Once I saw it, once I had discovered this about myself, when I went back and revisited the material, I recognized that there was a major omission there, that was such an important theme in the third degree that it needed to be addressed. And so that then became a new part of the book.
Interesting. That's really cool. But I do want to ask you a clarifying question.
You think maybe the Beatles might have influenced that idea?
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it.
Were you in? Yeah. Were you visiting Colorado when you had that realization? So earlier on, we talked about associating the whole man or the whole person with the Holy Guardian Angel. And just now you associated the old wise man with the Holy Guardian Angel.
Right.
Are they, well, I guess they both could be, but what is the old wise man lacking?
Well, that's interesting. In one sense, what the wise old man is lacking is innocence.
Oh.
Is innocence and ignorance. And so therefore the potential of discovery, of making mistakes, of you know, and some of them fortuitous, and the possibility of stumbling into something
so like
beautiful and unexpected and
kismet and serendipity and all of those fun
words. And I think ideally the wise old man recognizes the need for those things and so makes a place for you know, for the child, for the fool. But when a person kind of over-identifies, when the personality over-identifies with its perception of or its idealized image of the wise old man, then, you know, you run into a personality that can be kind of cold and dull and perfectly trying to appear to be perfectly harmonious and integrated and always possessed of equanimity and that sort of thing. And and that's a, you know, that's a farce. That's not a reality for human beings in this world. And so maybe there is occasionally a spiritual master or something like that. I think that's more those kinds of things are more a work of mythical fiction than they are of actuality.
I think so. It seems like the people that I've met that portray that image of themselves are there's some ego problems there.
Yeah.
That show up later. It's the people that I've met that are just, you know, normal folks that happen to also do the spiritual thing, and they're happy. They're the by far more advanced than the ones that I've met who portray this mask, this image of the wise, all-knowing mage of whatever. You know, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, the wisest, most integrated, most mature human beings that I know can really cut up and have a good time and can, you know, fuck up big time in the process. And
we don't cuss on this podcast, John.
Yeah, yeah.
I know better.
Wait, do they cuss in Texas? I thought they didn't cuss in Texas.
Oh, look. We invented cussing. Don't you know Texas? Let me tell you about Texas.
I think they did invent cussing. I'm pretty sure they did. It's funny. Speaking of, you know, stages of life, I was thinking this last weekend, I was thinking of the stained glass window in the blue room of the Guthrie Scottish Rite Temple.
Oh, the stages of what you just said, the stages of life, yes.
Stages of man, stages of life. And I was thinking about it because my twin daughters had invited me to Washington State University to their campus in Pullman for Mother's Weekend because I couldn't make Father's Weekend for work. But they took me to a frat party. So I'm standing in the middle of all of these frat kids that are just going, it's, you know, it's like a giant, not really a giant rave. It was a very crowded dance floor area. And I've got, you know, college kids just dancing all around and they're passing around bags of, they called it wine, but it was really Franzia. There was a band playing, you know, and I'm just like standing there and just feeling this awesome, youthful, vibrant energy and remembering what that felt like. And, you know, now I'm kind of like in the center stage and it's almost like that spark fades in some ways.
Yeah.
But it does and it doesn't. And I was enjoying the energy, but realizing it like that energy wasn't mine. It's theirs. And that's, it was a really beautiful moment as I'm sitting there thinking about this and thinking about those stained glass windows at the Guthrie Temple. And, you know, I didn't get super wild and crazy like I would have back in the day, but I you know, had a great time, got to know a lot of the frat guys and had a good night, but it was interesting seeing, you know, 'cause you just don't see that as an adult male. You just don't see that spark of energy.
Yeah.
At its height, at a frat party, and people are drinking and dancing to crazy music. You might see that often, Chuck, since you work.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, Chuck, I mean, working on the college campus, I get to see more of that. Yeah, than I think most people do. Yeah.
Sure.
It's inspiring.
It really is inspiring.
Especially, you know, when all of that energy is like included with, you know, integrated with some really sharp minds. Some of these kids are, my God, they're smart.
They are.
Yeah.
And you just want them to not get caught in the box of life.
Boy, no kidding.
Like, just do this. It doesn't matter. Forget about the money. Just run with it.
It's not. Yeah. It's not going to happen. They're all going to get caught in the box.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
So
not all of them.
Thank you for listening to part one of our interview with Chuck Dunning, the author of Contemplative Masonry: Basic Applications of Mindfulness, Meditation, and Imagery for the Craft. You can find Chuck's book on Amazon in paperback, hardback, or ebook form. And you can find us, My Alchemical Bromance, on the web at myalchemicalbromance.com. Thanks for listening, and come back soon for part two of our interview. I'm not going to be able to do that.